Hi, I'm Elizabeth Stoker. I write for The Week, Salon.com, periodically the Boston Review blog. I've written for the LA Review of Books, and right now I am at Cambridge University studying Christian theology. Next year I'll be at Brown University doing the very same thing. And I'm talking with Matt Brunig.
Hi, my name is Matt Brunig. I am a blogpreneur at mattbrunig.com, and I write elsewhere as well. I graduated from the University of Oklahoma many years ago.
So Matt, to start the discussion off on a religion and politics note, you had an April Fool's Day prank on your blog, mattbrunig.com, that we could play as a society on Hobby Lobby. Could you tell us about your prank?
Yeah, so my proposal... I note initially that Hobby Lobby pays corporate taxes, and those taxes go into the Treasury, and the Treasury, some of the Treasury money goes to Medicaid, and some of the Medicaid money goes to IUDs, and Hobby Lobby is opposed to IUDs, and opposed to paying for them, and so I said, well, what we should do as just a fun joke, you know, it would just be fun just for a day. We could set up accounts so that their corporate money, when they pay their taxes, instead of going through the Treasury, it would just go straight to meet the obligations of Medicaid. And there would be nothing in between. It would just go from one point to the other. I thought that would be interesting to see then, like, you know, what they would have to say about that. And maybe we already are doing that and they just don't even know about it. You know, and then like, what does that mean? Is that violated some freedom they have? Is that, have they done something wrong at that point? If we've been secretly setting up accounts like that, I'm not sure. So that's kind of what I wrote about.
Right. So, but this is an objection that business owners really do raise in terms of taxpayer money funding abortion during the debates about healthcare, which are, I mean, still ongoing, but. During the debates about, say, single-payer healthcare, one of the concerns that came up was, if I recall correctly, that taxpayer funds would be funding abortion. And periodically, there are stirs about Planned Parenthood getting taxpayer money for that same reason, because people don't want taxpayer money to fund abortions. So you see a parallel in the pools of insurance money that Hobby Lobby pays to the insurance providers that then at some point is going to pay for an objectionable device. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, basically, well, a lot of it just boils down to you trying to figure out, like, so how far do you follow the money? At what point does it stop being Hobby Lobby's money and does it become someone else's money? Like, that, for some reason, money has a persona attached to it at some level. It's always unclear where. In the insurance scenario, the money goes from Hobby Lobby to the insurer, and then from the insurer to a drugstore or an abortion provider in the abortion case. And that is a problem, I guess, except when the insurer spends the money on other people than the people who work for Hobby Lobby. Then that's okay. In that case, the Hobby Lobby money has been properly sanitized. All these sort of procedural hoops I find interesting, like when does money become clean money, devoid of its original owner? Of course, there was not even an original owner because the customer gave it to Hobby Lobby. So maybe it's the customer that's actually paying for contraception. I don't know.
So one of the objections that was raised to this problem, and I don't necessarily see this, the fungibility of money, the fact that the pools of money that are involved in Medicaid or that would be involved in single payer or that are involved in insurance companies that are then paid out. I don't see that as a knockout against Hobby Lobby's case, which just appears to be a larger case than they think that they're making. They appear to be making a really, really big case about this social allocation of resources. I mean, once you view money in this way, that you see that it doesn't really have a persona, and the culpability being tracked by ownership kind of turns out a lot fuzzier than you might think at first. It appears to be that the case they really should be making is about the allocation of resources in a society, which is much bigger than they want to make. They don't really want to go that high, probably for a number of reasons, but that's where it winds up. One of the arguments against that view that I received after I wrote a piece in The Week on this topic was that it came from Ross Douthat of the New York Times. Essentially, before a company contracts with an insurance provider, the money doesn't yet belong to the insurance provider. Whoever it belongs to, it doesn't belong to the insurance provider. And at that point, the business is culpable at that time point for whatever they contract for. And since there's a possibility when they contract with the insurer that objectionable things will be obtained, like abortifacient contraceptive devices, the business is culpable if they pursue that transaction. However, after a just wage has been paid to an employee, the business is no longer culpable because the money just isn't theirs anymore by the, you know, by law. It now belongs to the employee, and it's post control. Basically, it's past a point where they could control it. So, what do you make of that argument?
No, it's the same procedural hand waving. What do you mean it's post control? If the law forces you to pay for that health insurer, again, we're calling it pay, then in what meaningful respect do you control that money? In what meaningful respect are you controlling the contracting process that's involved in purchasing these things if the law is requiring you to do it?
I mean, that's the point we're at, is they're protesting that law.
And then what's the difference between that and having to pay a tax? In both cases, you have no control. No control. In fact, that actually overstates the facts here, because Hobby Lobby does have control, because if Hobby Lobby does not want to pay for these insurance plans, it doesn't have to. It can choose not to provide insurance at all and just pay a tax penalty. In fact, the way the law is set up, right, everyone pays the tax penalty, and providing insurance just gets you out of it. So,
right.
I mean, they already have the choice. But putting that aside, suppose that they didn't. Suppose they never had that choice and they were required to pay for it. I don't see how that is remotely different in terms of control, in terms of controlling the money, I'm deciding where the money goes, than a tax. But in both cases, the state has made the determination that that money is going to go over here or over there, and you really had nothing to do with it. You had no say over it. And that's how the state's sort of distributive apparatus has decided to allocate those resources in society. But I think your ultimate point here is correct. You're not going to be able to draw distinctions between these procedural mechanisms, because ultimately there really is none there. What you see is Hobby Lobby has some power within the existing legal norms and existing cultural structures to say that to perhaps exercise some power in this particular niche, and they want to exercise that power because they want to try to create the world that they want to create, and this is some place where they can do that, whereas other places, even though they're not really procedurally distinct in any meaningful way, they can't do that, and so they've kind of given up on that, and we get these specious arguments that tries to make distinctions that don't actually exist.
Right, and in the New York Times, Ross Douthat said basically that pluralism in a democratic society is about throwing up walls, is all about being able to kind of wall off your practice. And that's kind of where, in my opinion, that seems to be a little bit of a dodge, because the fact of the matter is that you can't maintain a wall. You can't maintain a wall in a transaction. You can't really trace, as we've been discussing, at what point is money sanitized? That's not clear. Ultimately, it comes down to a point about how we should allocate resources. And when you're making a point about how society should allocate resources, you're necessarily implicating everybody in the society. I mean, ultimately, everybody's equally entitled to our resources. And it's going to be a matter of what is the common good.
Yeah.
Which I think is a reasonable place to begin to reason from. But it makes it very difficult to reason within the kind of segmented off little tiny interior communities that seem to be what's defended here in this solution is the idea of the kind of atomized, tiny, insular community. Does that make sense?
Well, what make sense? Which part? That argument?
Well, the notion that ultimately we're going to have to end up reasoning from common good here.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing, right? Resources are scarce, and who gets what and where they're directed to is always driven by legal institutions, right? No, nothing inherently belongs to anyone. We construct what belongs to who by passing certain laws, setting certain norms, that kind of thing. And so everything's always trading off with everything else. And so the idea that you're able to like, well, I'll just wall this off. Well, there's no walling off, because in the alternative world, we could have used those same resources some other way, in ways that would have been less offending or something like that. And I think that's really where the problem comes in, is purely in the realm of like economic exchange and economic transactions. The walling off is really just not deeply possible, unlike other areas where you don't have the same kind of scarcity constraints. Like, for instance, when we're talking about like freedom of what goes on in my mind, right? I can believe what I want to believe, and that doesn't really, you know, impact anyone else, so long as I don't do anything, right, in my brain. But I can't like use some piece of the world for some use and have that not impact someone else when someone else wants to use it for some other thing. So you're always in a conflict when it comes to resource allocation. And, you know, like we were saying earlier, this is just one area where they think they have a sphere of power to actually push some resources in a direction towards the good as they see it. And so they take advantage of that.
I'm sort of puzzled as to why they don't frame it in that way. It seems like an opportune moment for a Christian corporation, although that's a whole nother ballgame. But at least it seems like an opportune moment for a Christian group of people to come before the state and say, we're trying to push policy toward the good. But they're kind of wincing away from doing that. All they're really willing to say is, we're trying to push policy toward the free, that we want religious people, religious corporations to have more freedom, to not have their freedoms infringed upon. When they could make the point, we're actually trying to push towards the good. These things are harmful. They're not good. They might be legal, but they're wrong. And by necessarily allocating fewer resources to them, we're actually helping people. But for some reason, that hasn't been a point that I've seen. I don't know if it's a rhetorical strategy.
I mean,
that they realize that would sink some of their power. Wouldn't be useful for before the court, but it might be useful in discourse.
Sure. No, I think it's the legal matter. That's all. I mean, the legal decisions turn on such ridiculous things that are so sort of unrelated to the substance, right? You have all of these kind of technical rules and technical doctrines, and you've got to find some way in that canon to articulate a point that can sort of plausibly punch through. I mean, it's the same thing like when we looked at Obamacare. Like, how absurd is it that, you know, what is it now? 7 million, I think they're saying 14 million with Medicaid. Their healthcare turned upon whether or not you wanted to describe the mandate as a tax or not. It's like, this is a ridiculous thing to turn policy on, but that's how you have to phrase it. The court has certain, you know, rhetorical canons, and you've got to phrase your comments in those canons. And I think the same thing is true in discourse as well. They're trying to persuade folks. And if you just say, hey, I think contraception is bad, boom, then other people are like, no, well, I think it's good. And so instead, you have to pretend and try to find some sort of procedural middle ground that seems substance neutral, in which to try to convince people that they should be on your side, regardless of what they think of contraception. And so, you know, it's the same sort of song and dance that you get with most procedural stuff. So
there's been a pretty interesting development in terms of the discussion of culpability here. To me, the fact of culpability in this argument has been pretty difficult to pin down. You know, someone is culpable somewhere for the use of abortifacient contraception, which I agree with. But it has been difficult to track where exactly it would stop. I guess that's one of my interests here that I'd like to bring up now is how would we actually fix this in a meaningful way for Hobby Lobby, in a way that could, you know, potentially make everyone happy? Or maybe the answer is that there's no way to fix it without some people being really unhappy. But to turn for a moment to Notre Dame, which has gone through as a Catholic university similar pains with this act, Grant Gallico of Commonweal recapped one of the court cases, and one of the excerpts was an exchange between Notre Dame's attorney and the judge in the case. So to quote the judge, who was named Hamilton, he asked, "Is it your position that if you sent a letter, basically a one-sentence letter stating that you needed to be exempt to the federal government then informed the necessary parties that its obligations had kicked in and the services would be provided, would that be a problem for you?" So essentially what the judge is asking is, if you want to be exempt from contraception coverage, if we allow you to send a one-sentence letter saying nothing more than we're a Catholic university, and then immediately the contraception will be provided directly by the state or some other party instead of the health insurance you provide or you yourself, would that be all right? So that was the question. Is that clear? And the answer out of the attorney at Notre Dame was yes, that would still be a problem, that we would still be culpable because by the very sending of that letter, we would be causing contraception to come to people. I would presume in the Hobby Lobby case, we might be looking at the same situation with culpability, that any motion we make, essentially, that ensures us on some level that abortifacient contraceptions are going to come into the possession of people and be used by them would be unjust, would be morally wrong. So with that in mind, what solution can you think of? Because single payer, obviously, in that situation wouldn't be a fix for a number of reasons we've outlined.
Well, I guess it would. I mean, it depends on what their logic is. I mean, you say, well, when I pay the single payer tax, I'm not causing contraception to be used. It's like, well, mm-hmm. I guess you're not.
But if people object now to Planned Parenthood receiving taxpayer money because they provide abortions, then certainly under single payer, it would be the same story. Planned Parenthood and other physicians would be paid by the state.
Yeah. If you listen to these people, they say they're okay with the Medicaid IUDs. So I don't really know. I mean, I don't really. I mean, like I said, I don't think there's really, I think it's just a sort of a function of what they can complain about and what power they have to exert in the spheres that they have it. I mean, in the case, for instance, in the case of the letter, they say, well, we're causing contraception to be used. Well, you're not causing contraception to be used, right? Because if the employees don't get contraception, then there's no contraception is used. Right? All you're doing is saying, we're not going to provide contraception coverage. And then the state goes, okay, well, so then we'll provide it, whether they want it or not. Like,
right. Well, I think that the broader point about culpability has some substance.
A lot of this, I think, I mean, causation is another, like, right, it's not actually a clear thing. What is causation? I mean, we have sort of but-for causes, and I think that's what they're getting at. They're like, well, but for the letter, there would be no contraception. So, but for that, we're causing it. I suppose, but I mean, in the same sense, like, but for your taxes, there's no Medicaid IUD. But for you being a university, right? I mean, there's no, you don't even have employees but for that. So maybe it's the fact that you're being a university that's causing it. Because if you didn't, then you obviously wouldn't have any enabling of IUDs.
Right.
So, you know, it's just, I just don't think there's any real, like, deep substance to this. It's just sort of, they have their intuitions about how they want the world to be, and they just sort of describe processes around that and use whatever power that they have.
One of the arguments that's been made in this case is that this is more or less just a feint, that you can account for all the inconsistency by saying this is just kind of an elaborate feint to target Obamacare writ large. Do you think there's any validity to that?
Well, I think some of the conservatives who write about it don't particularly care about the contraception stuff. I don't know if particular like institutions, like what their thoughts are. I mean, the Catholic Church, for instance, I don't think they're trying to attack Obamacare directly. They're trying to use the power they have to create the world that they want to see with regards to contraception.
Right. No. Yeah. The Catholic Church has been broadly supportive of of universal health care. The Catholic Church just wouldn't consider these things as things that care for health.
Yeah. That would be the case no matter how it was funded, no matter how what institutions right. you used. I mean, one of the institutions I proposed in one of my pieces on April Fool's Day about this was we could have an institution in which we never taxed anyone to pay for anything. Everything we paid came from dollars that we print from the Federal Reserve. So no one's actually taxed. In fact, the dollar literally comes into existence and then goes to the federal government, who then spends it. And then to offset the inflationary effects of that, we would tax people, and then we would take the revenue from that tax and just destroy it. We would just delete those dollars out of existence. So in like procedural terms, we have solved everything. At no point is any taxpayer money going to pay for anything. At no point does anything initiating from anyone go to pay anything. And we could simulate all of the things that we're doing right now. For instance, we could pay for everyone's contraception at Hobby Lobby and require Hobby Lobby to pay an anti-inflation tax equivalent to what we're paying for the contraception from money that we've printed from the Federal Reserve. And that would feel very similar. It would feel exactly the same. In fact, everyone would be doing literally the same motions with their bodies and everything else. But we've kind of procedurally rigged it so that Hobby Lobby doesn't spend anything. Hobby Lobby has got to give up some of its money for us to cut inflation, but that's it. None of the money that they're going goes anywhere. It literally goes nowhere. Literally, we throw it in the trash. And you could do that if you wanted to. You could set up your whole system of taxation that way. Do you think that they would stop objecting if you did that? You know, of course not.
No, right, because at the end of the day, and I think that's what becomes clear in the court arguments between Notre Dame and the court there, is that this is really about the outcome. Periodically, just because we sort of speak the language of procedural justice in our political discourse, and by that I mean we talk about things that would produce the most freedoms or do agree with the Constitution, and these are not worthless principles. But they are the language of procedural justice, making sure that we're going about things in a way that is just and legitimate. And because we conduct ourselves in that language so frequently, I think it's very hard to get people to sit down and say, here's what I want. Here's what the world should look like. On the other hand, I think it's easier in many cases to reason from a world picture. Here's the world I want. How close can we get? And then you do the how do we go about it dance through the procedural justice framework. But I think it's clearest in the Notre Dame argument that it's about the world we want. Because almost no level of abstraction, even writing a kind of cryptic little letter, is enough to get you out of the culpability cycle. So ultimately, it's not about walled-off practice. That is, can I actually genuinely practice my religion as much as it's about I'm doing my best here to make the world that I see as good. And it might be that they feel obligated, and quite rightly so, to do their best to make the world good. That might be what they're culpable for at the end of the day. It's not that I'm culpable for providing abortifacient contraception. It's that I'm culpable for not fighting it.
Yeah, that's an interesting... Yeah, I never thought of that. I mean, maybe if they lose the case or once they lose everything, they can at least be like, well, this was a sphere of power I maybe had, and so I had to try to use my power towards that end. But the second the court decides against me, that sphere of power has soaked up or has disappeared, and so then I'm not really complicit in anything anymore.
Right. Right, I have been dominated essentially by
the world. Yeah, it's outside of me. Or, I mean, I would view it the way that I tend to view all these sort of distributive things, is to say, I mean, you haven't so much been dominated as to say, well, no, the state has made the decision that, in fact, this money is not yours to control. You have some money that you control, have some money you can't control, and the stuff that you can't control is not really yours, so don't worry about it. You know, you're not culpable for how it's spent because it's not yours. The laws have allocated it in this way. It has nothing to do with you.
Right, or that there was a world in which an avenue appeared to be open to me through which I could exercise power to create a more moral world. I explored it. It was closed to me. There's nothing more I can do. I mean, I did the best I could. And therefore, I'm no longer culpable because all I was obligated and charged with was to explore that avenue as far as I could with good faith and good intention. And at the end of the day, it became shut off. And that is something that periodically Christians have to deal with. I mean, you live in a world where a state is a good thing, and a state has certain obligations to maintain order, which allows Christians to practice. And over again, you see theologians like, you know, Augustine and Bonhoeffer saying, basically, states become problematic when they begin to directly impede Christian practice. And I don't know if this would be a situation where you're saying, okay, it is directly impeding Christian practice, or if this Hobby Lobby situation is impeding Christian practice insofar as it expects Christians not to resist it, and that the Christian practice is in resistance, even if ultimately that resistance fails. That could be what's going on here, is I'm at least obligated to make a good act of resistance. And once the state fails, declares the money to be out of my possession, then there's no further I can really pursue it. That would be along the lines of what I wrote in my piece, that it's a symbolic act on some level. But I don't know how you would go about investigating that. Are there any parallels that you can think of where other groups have had to do something like that?
None come to mind. I mean, I feel like there's something a little bit... I still feel like in the economic sphere, I don't think that you can generalize it so far out to say, oh, well, you know, just sort of resist anything and everything. I think that there, in the economic sphere, there's something very special about the fact that there's scarcity involved, you know? And so, yeah, perhaps in that sphere, because there's scarcity involved, that we have to make these kinds of, all decisions about where things are going to go are at their root collective, because, you know, we have to have a system of laws that actually determines what goes to who and what belongs to who. Whereas other things are not so collective, and I don't know that you necessarily need to fight them. You know what I mean?
Can you give me an example?
Well, I mean, so like gay marriage is an example. Where it's like, well,
that's not collective.
It's not collective. It's not inherently collective in the sense that resources are, right? I mean, to say that if someone gets married, that doesn't have any sort of one-to-one trade-off effect with you. Now you can say, oh, it has cultural implications, and you could say it's bad for the people themselves who are getting married, and so maybe you should work to intervene in that. But your obligations there seem much different than when you're dealing with a collective allocation of resources. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, there's no scarcity involved. No one makes the case against same-sex marriage that now there's one less person for me to marry, and that's a right that I had. Mm-hmm. That's certainly not the argument that's made. I think that saying that marriage can be an individual kind of personal private practice institution is already presuming outside of a Christian frame.
Well,
because, right, in the Christian frame, marriage has direct social, it is a social institution. It's there to propagate society. Sort of the first unit of society is the family, a little tiny
society.
Sure,
it has. I don't mean to say it's not collective in that sense, but I just mean to say in a scarcity sense. And so in that way,
right.
It seems like you could imagine pockets of people who don't get gay married, you know, but you can't really imagine pockets of people who somehow have a simultaneous system of distribution of the resources in society that's different from the other one. You only have one. You can't have two, you know.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Is that it seems to be one of those cases where it would be easier to take a live and let live approach. And by my lights, that's what a lot of Christian denominations are doing at this point with same-sex marriage, is to say, well, we really can't control it. There's really not much point resisting it. And since it doesn't directly impact our practice, we might as well just, you know, either support it or maintain a neutral, positive attitude towards same-sex marriage. There are actually a lot of interesting arguments out in that sphere. But I do think they're operating under that liberal frame, which is, at the end of the day, not at all friendly to Christianity. In fact, to finalize the note of culpability here, Patrick Deneen in The American Conservative had a very interesting piece on the Hobby Lobby case, where he wrote, this economy, like the one it displaced, is not neutral. It is based on certain assumptions about human nature and implicitly teaches its participants to model their own behavior on those assumptions. But we should not deceive ourselves for a minute. That we are seeing is the contestation between a religious corporation and a secular state. We're seeing, rather, the culminating absurdity of what Polanyi called the utopia of our modern economic disembedding, the absurdity of a chain store representing the voice of religion in the defense of life amid an economy and polity that values turning people and nature into things. And I thought that was a very interesting round out to the discussion we've had about the difficulty of kind of putting a stopper on culpability here. It reminds me of a point John Milbank once made, which was that if the poor have to give something in exchange for money, then so do the rich. I mean, if you're going to take that poor owe something to get returns all the way down, then you're going to take it all the way up and say that everybody has to give something of social value and worth in accordance with what they need. And I think this is an example of, in the Hobby Lobby case, we've been looking at culpability all the way down, starting at Hobby Lobby and going down to the insurance company and then down to the consumer and then down to her personal medical choices. This is an example of looking at it all the way up. If Hobby Lobby is culpable in providing abortions at the end of the day, if it provides the insurance coverage that pays for them, then is Hobby Lobby also culpable all the way up into an economy that is basically friendly to those types of choices, to an economy that disembeds and commodifies and turns people into things? What do you think about that argument? Which I know you've read Polanyi, so.
Are they culpable? I mean, I don't know. I don't really know. I really don't have a lot of really strong intuitions on individual culpability for systems and that kind of thing. You know, I have a sense of what the system should look like, and I think people should try to make those systems happen. But when they don't or can't, I don't really know, you know, what to do. I mean, Hobby Lobby certainly is, you know, I don't know, what it is, some corporate employer, I presume its employees don't make very good money. Maybe they do. I don't know. I mean, it's a retail craft store, so you wouldn't expect that they would have much headway to pay high wages. That wouldn't get competed away by Michaels or whatever. So in that sense, you know, are they culpable for that? Are they culpable for the low wages of their workers? Or could they say, well, we can't help it. We have to pay them those low wages because that's the system we find ourselves in. And, you know, within sort of capitalist institutions, you know, that's what happens. You know, we can only pay them so much, what we can supply and demand and that sort of thing.
Right. And I certainly think that would be the response to Deneen's point that Hobby Lobby is a participant in a culture, in an economic culture that ultimately victimizes people. Deracinates and uproots people, and that leaves them vulnerable to the culture that we now find ourselves in. That is, as he says, you know, kind of anti-life and pro-sterilization and anti-family in a lot of ways. And in that case, I mean, if Hobby Lobby is, for example, using what amounts to slave or sweatshop labor to get its products and sell them cheaply, and then it's not paying its workers particularly well, and I mean, I don't know how we would. It's obviously paying minimum wage and not getting sued over that, but it might not pay a living wage. I don't actually know if they do or not. But even if it is paying living wage, it's still participating in an economy that is, at the end of the day, separated from the structures that once kind of held it down to the service of humankind instead of being what humankind serves.
I think that maybe that was one of his one of the points you do get is, well, you know, supposing even they are paying them well, there's still a sense of, well, how do you really conceptualize the people who work at Hobby Lobby? You conceptualize them as, like, they're a cost. They're a labor cost. They're something we have to sort of deal with in order to run our profitable business, you know, as opposed to treating them as, like, an end in themselves and that sort of thing. It's like, well, they're a cost that you have to bear in order to do business. People make those claims a lot, especially, like, those who are in a non-religious context talk about alienation and that sort of stuff, but...
Well, you have lots of people who talk about alienation in a religious context, too. Give us a break.
Well, I was just saying, but to that's what I'm familiar with.
To switch gears a bit, you made a comment at the opening of our conversation about the nature of property, sort of offhanded, saying, you know, property doesn't really exist properly in the way that it's usually spoken of. It just basically consists of laws that we make about ownership. Could you expand on that legal realist point a little bit, which does have a correlate in Christianity?
Yeah, this is a point. This is one of the points people pick up a lot. It's one of the ones that I've been pushing hard, and I guess not a lot of people talk about it that much. But so things exist. I'm in a house right now, and there's a computer here. But, like, ownership does not exist in a, like, a material way. Ownership is, it's a sort of socially constructed relationship. Like, pretty much everything that's built on top of just, like, things existing in the world, that's all just sort of human constructed things. Legal institutions and bureaucracies and I have the power to do this and to control that and you've got to do this and that, right? That, all that is kind of made up, and you can make it up in any number of ways. And the way you make it up has certain consequences, both on how things are distributed, how much is produced, stuff like that. But it's made up nonetheless. Whereas in our discourse, and part of the discourse that runs throughout is like religious freedom discussions, is we've kind of just sort of built into the background that that property, that specific laissez-faire property institutions in particular, even though they've never actually existed. In their complete form, I can't. You can't hear the your writing or something.
I'm sorry.
Forgot what I was.
Right, that they haven't always existed in their particular form right now, but they're now built into discourse in such a way that we have that.
Just assumes already these institutions, even when people are specifically debating them. Like, and that just runs over and over and over again. Like, the number of times I have to explain that when I'm advocating a tax increase, I'm not advocating taking something from you. I'm advocating not distributing as much to you in the first place, right? Like, what belongs to who is always constructed by legal institutions, and yet we have to contend with these notions that, no, you know, what belongs to who is always kind of, there's some sort of default core to it that's actually deeply real, like written into the universe. At some point, human beings evolved and came into existence, and so too did laissez-faire institutions of property and contract, too, for some reason. That one also is definitely real and is definitely not made up by people. And that's, you know, that's what we deal with in our discourse.
I think where people might disagree with you completely, and I think where a Christian disagreement with what I understand to be the secular argument you have just made might be, is that ownership itself doesn't exist. Certainly in the Christian frame, ownership exists. God owns things. God owns all the things. He made them. So they belong to him. And I think God's ownership is meant to be exemplary. It shows us what good modeled ownership looks like. So ownership as a principle exists, but in your frame, it doesn't even exist as a principle. Is that right? It's just a series of structures that have to do with violence, more or less.
Well, you just have to ask yourself, what is ownership? What do you mean it exists? What, like, it exists. We have institutions of ownership. They are real, just like taxes are real.
But I think in the Christian frame, God's ownership of things says something about the nature of the thing. Its createdness and its giftedness define it. And in that sense, God's ownership defines it, which is, like I said, probably not particularly useful in the secular frame. But I think that idea that God owns everything and that God's ownership characterizes his created things actually can mesh with the kind of proprietary vision that you have in mind. St. Augustine and St. Ambrose, both teacher and student, seem to kind of take a similar view, and I've sent you some of their work. And do you have the read that they view it, ownership, essentially the same way that you do?
Yeah, I mean, separate from whether God owns things, right, within our debate, that's sort of in the background. The question is, do people own things, right?
Right.
And I think that's their position, or at least Augustine's position, the one that you send me. He says, you know, the world belongs to God, and he gave it to mankind to use in common. Everything sort of specific about how we're using it, these are all human things. We all made them up. Emperors have made them up, right? He says they're not divine rights, they're human rights, which I understand to mean, like, you know, the rights people construct for themselves, and so ownership is always, you know, sort of based upon those inventions.
Right. Which people appear to have the power mandated from God to construct rights for themselves. It's not to knock against a right that it's merely a positive sort of political right.
No, certainly not. But the question is, how do you, if you're constructed, I think that's the problem is, once you say that they're constructed, or I think the reason they don't want to say that they're constructed, a lot of conservatives, is because once you say that they're constructed, that means that we are authoring them. And if we're, like, authoring them, then, well, we have certain responsibilities to author them in ways that are fair and equitable and so on. And it really doesn't seem like laissez-faire institutions are that, insofar as they create serious inequalities and bottom-end deprivation and stuff like that. That's avoidable. If you adopt other institutions, but by pretending like they just exist, then you don't ever have to deal with the question of, well, how should we make them? You just say, well, we don't make them; they just are. And the things that we make are any things that deviate from laissez-faire institutions, and then those are the ones that somehow have to have special scrutiny and special justifications, and also involve theft, right? Because the laissez-faire institutions, the way that they distribute things, those are the real way that things are distributed deeply in the world, truly, and so everything else is theft, and so we also have to deal with that. So I think that's the point that you're going to make, right, is within the religious frame, to the extent that we have to author rules on resource use, and they don't just exist, then we have duties to do those in a specific Christian-friendly way.
Right, and I mean, that's a point that's been made by, you know, scholars far more intelligent and well-researched and illustrious than myself. I mean, most recently, Pope Francis, right? That's what he came under extraordinary fire for, was saying that, well, if we're going to have an economy, it shouldn't be an economy that excludes people. It shouldn't be an economy that leaves people in desperate poverty and extraordinary inequality. And when he said that, it was with reference to the idea that these institutions are created institutions. In fact, all of existence is created. These happen to be created by the creatures. The economy is a creaturely thing. We made it. And so far as we're making it, we have an obligation to make it correctly. And I think that in a strange way, the Hobby Lobby arguments hook into that analysis, right? That if we're going to make things, if we're going to allocate resources, we're going to create the structures that push resources around, resources that are then turned into IUDs or abortifacient forms of contraception or abortions themselves, then we have an obligation to do that rightly. I think that's correct. But what's so provocative about Pope Francis' analysis is it doesn't stop there, right? It goes all the way up and all the way down. So yes, obviously, we shouldn't be funding anything that brings about the cessation of human life. that's antithetical to what the economy should do, which is serve humans and serve an orderly society. On the other hand, if we're going to take that seriously, then we also need to allocate resources in such a way that they support human lives, which means allocating them towards the support and service of the poor and not allowing or creating desperate poverty and inequality. I think that is the real zinger at the heart of the Hobby Lobby case when you get down to the logic of it, insofar as I read it anyway.
Yeah. Well, I mean, basically, to me, the way I like to think about it is the economy is a set of rules that we, the structure of the economy, at least, is a set of rules that we create through our legal institutions. And so here you would imagine, well, what kind of rules should we create? Should we create rules that permit contraception to be produced, or should we not? And you'd say, well, we should not create those rules.
Right. So I have a question for you, just on the topic of writing about the economy. Being here in the United Kingdom, I have come across a lot of European writing on economies and their purposes, and I repeatedly see the principle of human dignity raised, even in secular writing, especially continental secular writing, although it appears to have come into that philosophical tradition from the Catholic intellectual tradition. Nonetheless, it is raised very frequently here, and I see it much less frequently in American discourse. So as someone who writes about the economy in a U.S. frame, do you see the principle of human dignity as having a place in discourse in the United States, or should it? Or what would it mean?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, it's important. Human dignity is an important goal. I think the problem is that it's hard to, at least in the context, a lot of the writing I do is very technical and it's very, like, data-driven, and that's not really something that you can measure meaningfully. Right. So, you know, I tend to focus more on material questions of making sure people have enough and have an as equitable share of the things as possible. And I think that's going to always be a plus for dignity. But beyond sort of the dignity inherent in egalitarian institutions, which, you know, it's dignified to have enough stuff so that you don't have to beg or you don't have
right.
And it's also dignified to be as close to others as you can so that you don't have those like estrangements, and then that drives all sorts of animus and stuff like that. Beyond that, there are, I guess, just sort of like organizational questions of what kinds of structures that have nothing to do with distribution, what impact they have on dignity. So, you know, you have a boss, and the boss tells you what to do. There's some, like, really obscene thing. Like, I think Corey Robin uses the example of, I don't remember what it was, but some factory was, like, making their employees wear diapers so that they couldn't go to the bathroom and stuff like that. That's not really, isn't really very little to do with sort of distribution of income and stuff, but obviously you don't want that, I would think.
So it seems almost like the difficulty in quantifying human dignity is a plus here. Because if it were a checklist, anytime you have checklist type rules, it's fairly easy to get around them. You can always come up with a loophole. Well, I filled out that one. I mean, I'm not, you know, for instance, you might not make an employee wear a diaper, but you could compose other diabolical ways to eliminate waste from people without allowing them to do it in the way that they want to, that's comfortable. So obviously, a checklist form of human dignity wouldn't be helpful in that situation. Therefore, a human dignity that you always have to contemplate, that causes you to sit down and really search out in the parameters of the society that we have now, with the resources available to us now, and the style of living that is available to the majority of people in this society, is this a dignified way to proceed with the treatment of workers? Might be actually kind of helpful.
Yeah, I think, but the downside is that the debates end up being very vague, and
right.
people just take the preferences that they have, and they just call them dignity respecting. You know, I could certainly see someone saying, oh, this tax, it destroys my dignity, you know, the dignity of keeping what I make or something like that. And it's just, you know, pretty much can say whatever you want, I imagine. I mean, and that's not to say that there's not like a real core to it. It's just to say that it's just easily abused in a way that makes it hard to deal with as a matter of like engagement.
Right. I know. I think Paul Ryan has made a lot of comments on that order.
Yes. Getting free lunch at school is bad for dignity, I think was one of his positions relative to your parents producing the lunch. That was his position.
Right. That it would be less dignified to take a free lunch from the school as a child than it would be for your parents to pay for you to have the lunch. Or I suppose it would be even less dignified than not having a lunch. Was that part of the implication there?
No. I don't know. It got really confused because like eventually I guess it turned out that the story was more that the kid wanted a sack lunch instead of a paid lunch. He wasn't actually getting free student. He wasn't actually getting the free or reduced price lunch program. He just didn't want to have to like buy the tray of food, which probably, I mean, yeah, that's just sensible in itself. I don't even know. I feel like he might have been making up the dignity story to get like a PBJ or something. But I don't know. Yeah, that was his position. And some of that, although I think that there's something interesting about that because some of the, you know, what is dignified and what isn't dignified, it is going to be a function of sort of like social and cultural understandings, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's no, a 5 or 6 year old child or an 8 year old child certainly does not inherently think, oh, I go to the register and I don't pay. I can't imagine that just like, hardwire into the brain that affects them, right? What affects them is that people look down on the poor and then eventually they start to come to understand that.
Right. And the other kids torment them.
Yeah,
or,
but that's all. Or so there's nothing really undignified about it per se. It's all about social relations and how those, you know, structure what we, you know, how we feel about that.
Which again might not be a knock to the principle of human dignity having kind of a primacy in value discourse. Because at the end of the day you do exist in a social context and I think it's a disease rather than a feature of our discourse to pretend as though we can be abstracted from the cultures and societies that we live in. Of course we can't. We are very tightly knit into them.
Yeah. Well, I think that's true. I imagine there are core things that are going to be less contingent upon social attitudes and stuff like that. They're probably like always going to be a little bit undignified, you know. I guess there are things that are more socially calibrated than others, or more universal to humans than others that might make them feel undignified. But the issue with those things that are socially, socially generated dignity issues is that you can resolve them in very strange ways. Like it doesn't so much make sense to say, hey, people have animus towards poor folks, and so we should make them more poor because some of the things we do to make them less poor are too conspicuous. It's like, well, maybe tell people to stop being such jerks, I guess I would say, to poor people. That might be a better way to go about it.
Which would actually be just a great policy prescription in general.
Yeah.
At this point.
Or, I mean, there's always other ways. Yeah, everyone could have free lunch. There's so many different approaches to it, but.
Right.
You know, you can use, I guess you could say you're building malicious trends, malicious sentiments on top of more malicious sentiments, and you wind up just into a pit of despair.
Where the principle of human dignity obviously doesn't have a lot of sway over how you structure your society at that point. And it falls out as being both productive of undignified situations and characteristic of them at the same time. So thank you so much for talking with me. I'm glad we got to hash out this Hobby Lobby case, and we'll see if they take you up on your April Fool's joke next year.
All right, thanks.
Thanks. Bye.